How does this happen? In fact, there is some mystery. There is something which we do not know. Life seems to be moving in areas about which we are not aware at all. In other words, there are things which break down the whole law of predictability. There is something unpredictable. Of course, from the standpoint of human relationship, thank God there is something unpredictable. Otherwise, what will happen? There is a book written by an engineer, engineer turned a philosopher, and it's a book called Journey Within. In that book, he gives an instance. He said, he found a lady who was in difficulties, who had some problems, and she telephoned to the doctor and said, "Doctor, I want to see you." And the doctor gave an appointment. And the lady went to the doctor. When the lady went to the doctor said, "Why have you come? We know that you are a happily married couple. You have never spoken with raised voices to each other. Your life is very, very quiet. There is absolutely no trouble whatsoever. But why have you come? What is your difficulty?" Because this doctor was a psychotherapist. "Why have you come to me? What is your problem?" And the wife said, "Yes, doctor, you are right. We are happily married. We have not spoken with each other with raised voices. But there is one question that I want to ask." And the doctor said, "What is the question?" The lady says, "Doctor, I want to know whether I am living with a husband or am I living with a computer? I want to know, am I living with a husband or am I living with a computer? Because with computer you can't quarrel." She said, "I wish my husband would quarrel sometimes with me. But he is something like a computer, does all the work. There is no fault about it. You have not to raise your voices. But this is a fact." In other words, thank God, as I said, that in human relationship one finds the factor of unpredictability. This factor of unpredictability is being noted more and more by modern science. That even though we raise a superstructure of law and of rules, something happens where life does not seem to be moving along that, but breaks down the structure of law that has been built up. In fact, today, in terms of the quantum physics, quantum mechanics, we know that there are many things that have to be revised. And one of the things that to be revised is the whole cause and effect relationship. Do we know cause and effect relationship? Or is there something that is happening which breaks down the whole structure of cause-effect edifice? Now the Bhagavad Gita, years ago, thousands of years ago, referred to this. In one beautiful shloka, in beautiful verse, the Bhagavad Gita said that in every action there are five constituents. In every action, five constituents. It says, first of all, there is the actor. One who acts. Secondly, it says that there is the pattern of action. There is, thirdly, the instrument of action. There is the other factor which one may call about the play of action. Action expressing itself in a diversity of ways. It says all these things are to be seen in action. The same action that can be performed in a different manner. All these things one can understand. But the Bhagavad Gita says there is a fifth factor. And the fifth factor is described in the Bhagavad Gita as daivam. Daivam means something unpredictable. You may have planned everything, and yet something unpredictable comes and disturbs the apple cart of all our action. Everything is gone. We had planned everything in detail, great many details. But there is something that is unpredictable which comes. This element of unpredictability is being noticed more and more by modern physics, that there seems to be this unpredictable element. And because of this unpredictability, even though you may plan and plan, but your plan may sometimes go completely awry, they may be completely disturbed because of this unpredictable factor. Does it mean that we must not plan? Does it mean that the law of karma has no operation? No, it doesn't mean that. Plan by all means. But when you plan, do not be so rigid and so fanatic and so dogmatic. Let the mind still be open. that something unpredictable may happen, and the mind that is ready to receive the unpredictable factor is an intelligent mind. The mind that organizes the areas of predictability, and yet the mind that is still open to the arrival of the unpredictable, is an intelligent mind. It is that mind which will be able to understand the ways of nature, because nobody can understand completely the ways of nature. Nobody. For example, Bertrand Russell says at one place that we mathematicians prove many, many things through mathematics, but we do not know what we are proving. We do not know what we are proving. We are proving, we can give proof after proof, but we do not know what we are proving. It's the same problem like the Keno Upanishad. Who is doing all this? Who is doing all these things? That was the question that was put by the pupil of the Keno Upanishad. This is the question that is here. For example, if you turn to that very fascinating, interesting book, The Dancing Woolly Masters, written by a scientifically minded people, written in a language which is not technical at all, and so the non-technical people can understand all the scientific aspects that he discusses. And he says in that book that the scientists have noted more than 100 dances of the particles. More than 100 dances of the particles. But we say, while we know the dances of the particles, who is the dancer? Who is dancing? We do not know who is dancing. We do not know what is that particle. We have not seen that particle. We have seen the behavior of the particle. But what is that particle? We do not know what that particle is. In other words, we do not know who the dancer is. How are we to know? The teacher of the Keno Upanishad replies, when he comes to the end of the discussion in that particular Upanishad, the teacher of the Upanishad says, you want to know who does this? I'll tell you how to find that who. What is nature? What is God? What is life? You want to know. He says, I will teach you how. He says, that which is who, whom you want to know, can be discovered in a flash of lightning, or he can be discovered in the twinkling of an eye. Flash of lightning does not continue. If it continues, it is no flash at all. Similarly, in the twinkling of an eye, you can know it in the twinkling of an eye. That is what Kabir says in the song that was sung. Kabir says, if you know how to seek, in a moment you will find. But we are trying to find him only in the duration of time. In the duration of time, he cannot be found. In the duration of time, there is no solution to this mystery. In the duration of time, we cannot understand the phenomenon of the unpredictable. It is only in the flash of a lightning. It's only in the twinkling of an eye. It is only in that moment, about which a great book of theosophical mysticism, Light on the Path, says at one place, the pause of the soul is the moment of wonder. The pause of the soul is the moment of wonder. When there can come a pause, unfortunately there is no pause in our life. Remember, pause cannot be brought about artificially. But we have no pause. Our life is lived so fast. We have no time at all. We have time for everything. No time to know what life is. We have time for everything. We can't even sleep. We have forgotten the art of sleeping. We may feel sleepy in a lecture room, but we don't have sleep in the bedroom. We must have more and more pills, sleeping pills, in order to sleep, because we have lost the art of sleeping, the art of relaxation. There is no pause at all. There is no interval, there is no creative interval whatsoever. Everything happens only in that creative interval. But we do not know what that creative interval is. May I say, the whole philosophy and the psychology of the Upanishad is nothing but the philosophy of the creative interval, or the psychology of the creative interval. In the Ishavasya Upanishad, about which I made a reference, it says, look at life as it comes, whatever it is. Don't condemn it, don't accept it, nothing. Let the mind be in a state of, in that critical state, absolutely in a critical state. Because the mind that does not accept and does not reject is really a critical state. And everything that is fundamental happens only in a critical state. For example, if you turn to the writings of that great Belgian scientist Prigogine. Prigogine has made an astounding statement. He talks of the order arising out of chaos. About that Prigogine speaks in that book, The Order from Chaos. That is what he says. If we can come to that critical state, because it is only in the critical state that somehow that takes place a sort of a reversal of the process of nature. Nature reverses itself. And in that critical state, there seems to be coming order out of so-called chaos. We are never in that critical state. You know, when the chemical solution is brought to a critical state, and if you just drop into that critical solution a seed, the whole solution becomes crystalline. It's a fundamental change that takes place. It's a qualitative change that takes place. But it has taken place because of that critical moment. If our minds could come to the critical moment, then in that critical moment, the fundamental change is bound to take place. But we never come to that critical moment. Why? Because we are afraid of ourselves. We are literally afraid of ourselves. We are afraid of others. We may be afraid of others. But far more than that, we are afraid of ourselves. Because we can get away from other people, but we can't get away from us. And therefore, we do not want to look at ourselves. Meditation is really a moment of looking into ourselves. But leave that apart. But we have never looked at ourselves to find out what we are. Are we really in the know of what we are? Or have we imagined what we are? That is what Patanjali says. Patanjali uses the word asmita. Asmita means a false identification. We live only by a false identification, by the image. It's my image, my image. My image must not be broken. You must not damage my image. You may do anything you like, but don't insult my image. I am all the time guarding the image. But the image has no existence per se at all. The image is something which the mind has created. And this is exactly the fear of death that we have. In the Bhagavad Gita, when Shri Krishna says to Arjuna, Arjuna, what are you afraid of? Are you afraid of death? Then the famous statement that is made in the Bhagavad Gita is, Shri Krishna says to Arjuna, Arjuna, remember, that which exists, that which really exists, has no death. It never ceases to exist. And that which has no existence, that which is only an image, it cannot continue. It is all the time subject to death. What are you weeping about? Are you weeping about the unreal or are you weeping about the real? If you are weeping about the unreal, then it has no existence whatsoever. If you are weeping about the real, then it never ceases to exist. Then what is your weeping about? Surely your weeping about has no reason whatsoever. Because you seem to be weeping either for the real or for the unreal. In both cases, the weeping has absolutely no meaning whatsoever. In other words, we do not realize that we have only created the images. It is only the image that lives. You and I don't live. It is the image that lives. And we are guarding the image, nourishing the image. We have built up self-defense mechanisms in order to guard that image. And these defense mechanisms have created strain and stress. So far as our daily life is concerned, what are we to do then? What is the way which the Upanishad suggests? In that Upanishad about which it speaks of living for 100 years easily, the Upanishad says that don't lead a second-hand life. Lead an original life. Why don't you lead an original life? Because this original life is something which has a vitality, which has a substance in it, which will never die. It has tremendous energy. It can renew itself if you understand what the original state is. What is this original state? There are 4 words that are used in that Upanishad. And the 4 words are Kavi, Manishi, Paribhu, Swayambhu. I'm using Sanskrit words. Some of you may be able to make out something. It says, look at life, approach life from 2 standpoints. The standpoint of a poet and a seer, and the standpoint of an intellectual man. Let intellect and also the heart function together. not the head knowledge, but the soul wisdom. The soul wisdom can come only when the mind and the heart function together. We are becoming in this computer age more and more like computers. There is much of head learning, but there is no soul wisdom. The soul wisdom comes only when the mind and the heart function together, not one after the other, but the mind and heart together, absolutely together, so that whenever we function, there is the mind that is involved, but at the same time the heart is involved, the mind and the heart. Then this Upanishad says, if you can know how to behave in this manner, then you will have created space in your consciousness. Paribhu, there will be space in consciousness. At present there is no space in our consciousness. It's all cluttered up with all sorts of junk, and we don't want to get rid of that junk. And so it is full of it. There is no space in this consciousness. If there is no space, nothing new can ever enter. Because if something new enters, it has no space to walk about. And therefore it says, create space in your consciousness. And you will be able to create space in consciousness when the mind and the heart function together. Not just the intellect, not just the emotion, but intellect and emotion together. Because in the togetherness of the intellect and emotion, there comes into existence what is known as intelligence, what is known as the insight. There comes into existence the insight. And this insight has created tremendous space. Into that space will come what is known as the original, as the new, Swayambhu. Nobody has created it. That which has not been created by anybody is the Swayambhu. It is the original. That original will take birth so far as your consciousness is concerned. In the Patanjali Yoga Sutra, with which many of you are familiar, Patanjali, while he describes many types of samadhi, many types of spiritual ecstasy, he leaves the seventh type of ecstasy up to the end. He discusses the six varieties of ecstasy in the earlier chapters. But in the last chapter, almost towards the end of the Patanjali Yoga Sutra, Patanjali speaks about the seventh form of spiritual experience. When does it come, he says. And he says it can come only when you approach life without a moneylender's mentality. Don't carry moneylender's mentality into what you call the spiritual experience. What is moneylender's mentality? I give a loan of money. Why? Not because I am suddenly charitable. I give because I want a reward. I want a dividend. I want an interest. The term that is used in the Bhagavad Gita is akusida. Kusida in the Sanskrit language means moneylender. Akusida. Prasankhyane akusidasya. Dharma mega samadhihi. Patanjali says, when there is no motivation, when your consciousness is absolutely innocent, no motivation whatsoever, no desire for reward or punishment, nothing. When there is neither reward nor punishment, neither acceptance nor rejection, when the mind is in that state, then he says, there takes place the bursting of the cloud of benediction. Dharma mega samadhi. The bursting of the cloud of benediction takes place. Then you experience something that comes from above. Something that comes outside the limits of the mind. Something that does not belong to the product of the mind. Something that has come from outside. Call it outside, call it above, call it whatever you name you like. But it is not something that is the product of the mind. It is a transcendental experience. And this transcendental experience can come. That is what grace is. As Sri Aurobindo says, in one of his books, grace never withdraws from man. It is man who withdraws from grace. Grace never withdraws. Because we have closed the doors. There is a very beautiful story in Sufi literature. In Sufi literature, one disciple goes to the teacher. The teacher is the woman saint, or saint of Sufism. And he goes and says, please, tell me, I am knocking at the door of reality for quite some time. But the door never opens. Why? Why does not that door open? Then this Sufi saint says to this disciple. You may go on knocking at the door of reality for 1,000 years, but the door will not open. He said, but why will it not open? Is there anything wrong in the way in which I am knocking? She said, no, you may go on 1,000 years and yet it will not open. Why? For the simple reason that the door has never been closed. For the simple reason that the door has never been closed. But I do not see it. I am knocking at the open door and I say the door does not open, the door does not open. Why? Because of those projecting factors of the mind. The mind projects. The mind that is conditioned goes on projecting. And therefore it is never able to see what is. It is only when the mind and the heart can function together, the intellect and emotion functioning together, that there will be enormous space. In that space, it will be possible for us to see what is, not see that which has been projected by the conditioning factors of the human mind. This is the question of questions. But one might say, how to come to it? The Upanishads have always said that joy or bliss is the ultimate foundation of every universe. Joy, bliss, that is the foundation of life. But you and I don't agree with the Upanishad. We say, where is joy, where is bliss? It's all suffering, it's all sorrow. Where is joy and where is bliss? And we complain to God if we believe in God. Why did God create this unjust world where it is the good man that suffers and it is the evil man that seems to be prospering? Why did God create such a world? But God says, if we can listen to Him, God says all the time, you have never looked at my world. You have only looked at your world. And whatever you find in your world, for that you blame me. I have not created it. I have created always something that is happy and joyous and blissful. It is you who have created this world. And it is true that you and I live not in the world that is, but in the world which we have created. We have created a world out of our projections of the mind. And we think that what we have projected is the fact. It is the relative being mistaken for the absolute. And that is why we have never looked at life as it is. And the mind, so long as it functions, it will never allow us to look at life as it is. And what is to be done? We say, oh, I must silence the mind. Try it. If you try to silence the mind will become more agitated. The mind cannot be made silent. The mind becomes silent. It cannot be silenced. It is a fact that our mind is all the time agitated, all the time agitated. When we want to meditate and we say, I want to concentrate on a particular thought, try. If you have not noticed, you notice it tomorrow. That when I give a thought to my mind, that I want to reflect upon it, See where you are after 2 minutes. After 2 minutes, that thought is no longer there. Probably you are doing something else. You may be eating apple pie. You are not there at all, because the mind has moved away. And the mind moves at a speed which is far, far greater than the speed of light. It moves away. How to bring this mind under our hands to control it? That is what Arjuna said to the Lord. Lord, your philosophy has no value to me. The Lord said, why? Why has it no value? He said, it has no value because I can't control my mind. And so show me how to control the mind. If you can show me how to control the mind, so that I am able to control the flow of thought, not the flow of thought carrying me, but I am able to manipulate the flow of thought. If you can show me, this is exactly what has been shown in all the major scriptural texts of the Hindus and the Buddhists. All the scriptural texts, right from the Vedas, and you can come down to the present times. It is the same formula, it is the same technique that is being used. That is the technique which has been elaborated in the Upanishads. There are two Upanishads. There is the Mundaka Upanishad and there is the Shvetashvata Upanishad. There is, of course, the Mandukya Upanishad. The Mandukya Upanishad is the key to the understanding of Hindu psychology. Because the Mandukya Upanishad speaks of the four grades of awareness. And it speaks, therefore, of the waking state, of the dream state, of the deep sleep state, and the fourth or the transcendental state. What is the waking state? The waking state is awareness with choice. If I am awake, then surely I must be able to make a choice. Where does this road go? Where does this road go? And so I am able to make choice because I am awake. And therefore the waking state of consciousness, perhaps we are in that state or perhaps we are not in that state, but we must come to that, the waking state, where I must be able to decide my choices in terms of the mind. The mind must be sharp, the mind must be active, the mind must be alert. Although the mind cannot give me the solution, I must first of all come to the alertness of the mind so that I have exhausted all that the mind can give me. That is the waking state, to know in any given situation what are the alternatives. What are the alternatives that the mind is prepared to place before me? That is what is called the waking state. The awareness with choice. The dream state is awareness without choice. Because when we have a dream, we can't choose. We can say, oh, I don't want to appear myself in dream as an evil person. I want to appear as a saintly person. You can't choose in dream. The moment you choose, the dream is over and you are wide awake. And therefore in dream state, you have to accept whatever comes. That is what is called awareness without choice. I'm not talking of the choiceless awareness. I'm talking of awareness without choice. It is different from the choiceless awareness. And therefore there is the awareness with choice in the waking state, awareness without choice in the dream state, and there is a third awareness in deep sleep. The awareness of non-awareness. The awareness of non-awareness. If I am aware that I am asleep, I am not asleep. It is only when I am not aware that I am asleep. The sleeper must not be aware of himself. Then only the deep sleep comes. The awareness in non-awareness. There is not that awareness that I am sleeping, I am sleeping, I am sleeping. Then the sleep is gone. And therefore the deep sleep level of consciousness about which the Upanishad speaks is that where the sleeper is not aware that he is sleeping. I am not enlarging upon these states of consciousness. Then we come to the fourth state of consciousness, which is called in the Upanishad as the transcendental state, which is the condition of pure awareness. Pure awareness from where the perceiver and the perceived, the experiencer and the experience, all are gone. It is just pure awareness. It is this pure awareness about which the Upanishad speaks, and it is this pure awareness to which our meditation must bring us. But it does not bring us because of the constant agitations, constant movement, constant chattering so far as the mind is concerned. How is this chattering of the mind to cease? There are two Upanishads. There is the Mundaka Upanishad and the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, in which there is a simile of two birds. Two birds exactly alike, sitting not only on the same tree, but on the same branch of the tree. These two birds. One bird is eating the fruit of that tree, the other bird is watching. One bird is eating the fruit, the other bird is watching. This is the simile that you find in these two Upanishads. Beautiful simile. Two birds. Two birds are not two individuals. Two birds are ourselves. There is the conscious mind and there is the subconscious mind. Let the conscious mind look at what the subconscious does. Let the conscious mind be just a witness. Don't suppress it. Let the subconscious eat the fruit if it wants to eat the fruit. But let the conscious mind see what the subconscious is doing. And all these techniques that are given either in the Veda or in the Upanishads, in the Bhagavad Gita, in the Patanjali Yoga Sutra, in the Yoga Vasishta, all these books have given this one technique. The technique is observe what your mind does. Be a witness to the activities of the mind, the motivations of the mind. Just be a witness. That is what Sri Krishna said to Arjuna. You want to know how the mind can become still? Just witness what your mind is doing. Let the conscious mind look at the subconscious. And if the conscious mind can look at the activities, the motivations, the likes and dislikes of the subconscious as it manifests itself, then in that very looking, the subconscious will become silent, it will become quiet. You don't have to quieten it. It becomes quiet because you have listened to all that it has to say. And because you have listened to all that it has to say, subconscious, as so far as that particular subject is concerned, nothing more to say. It has become quiet. It is the quiet of the mind. It is the silence of the mind. It is the stillness of the mind. It is in that quiet, in that stillness, in that silence, that something that is original, something that is new, something that is in the form of a grace, or call it by whatever name you like, it is that something which descends into the consciousness, into the silent consciousness. This is the spiritual magnet about which I was speaking this morning. This is the spiritual magnet. In the very presence of it, all the scattered facts of life, they form themselves into one pattern. There is no disorder. The order has come where till now there was disorder. The total order has come with the arrival of that spiritual magnet, the arrival of that something in the deep silence of the mind, where the conscious has been a witness to the activities of the subconscious, then there happens a miracle. Happens a miracle in that state of silence. What is that miracle? That miracle, to a certain extent, has been given expression to by Edwin Arnold in his Light of Asia. In the Light of Asia, Edwin Arnold says at one place, while describing liberation, nirvana, he says, what is nirvana? And the beautiful line that you find in Edwin Arnold's Light of Asia is, the dewdrop slipping into the shining sea. The dewdrop has slipped into the shining sea. But is that all? This seems total negation. What happens is further explained by H.P. Blavatsky, Inner Voice of the Silence. Madame Blavatsky, who was the founder of the Theosophical Society. In the Voice of the Silence, she uses the phrase, the drop in the sea in the drop. In other words, when the dewdrop slips into the shining sea, a great miracle takes place. What is that miracle? The entire sea enters the dewdrop. The entire sea enters the dewdrop. The small individual consciousness is widened because the universal consciousness enters that individual consciousness. This is the miracle. This is the wonder that takes place in the moment of that pause. This is the experience of meditation, the experience of spiritual life. And this is the way which the Upanishads have pointed out to us. The two birds, one bird eating the fruit, the other bird watching. The subconscious interested in its activities, in its unfulfilled desires. But the conscious mind just watching it. If the conscious mind can just watch, then because of that silence, we shall know what reality is. Then knowledge will be transformed into wisdom. No longer shall we talk about knowledge by ideation. We shall be able to talk of knowledge with identity. And we will be able to declare with the Upanishads, Brahmavid Brahmaiva Bhavati, the knower of the Brahman becomes Brahman. This transformation takes place. This is what the Upanishads have said. This is how the way of the Upanishad can be trodden. There is the way of the Upanishad, the non-dual way of the Upanishad. But the non-dual way of the Upanishad can be trodden by this process about which we have discussed. If only the conscious mind can look at the activities of the subconscious without doing anything, not suppressing it, not indulging in it, but just looking at what the subconscious does, allowing the subconscious to speak. Because the subconscious is like a child. When the child has seen something, it's full of it. And the child wants to express. But invariably the father suppresses the child. Says, no, I'm very busy, don't talk about me. The child goes to the mother. Because the mother is prepared to listen to the child. And if you can listen to the child, then the child will tell its story in less than a minute and run away. This is exactly the case with regard to the subconscious. Listen to what the subconscious has to say. That listening is the process of meditation. In that listening, the subconscious becomes silence. Then we find that a miracle has taken place. The entire sea has entered the dewdrop, the individual consciousness has widened into our universal consciousness. Thank you very much.
According to the Upanishads, then, should we make moral judgments or take social action if we're trying to live in the now?
Must make a moral judgment, but the question is, who is judging? Is it the mind that is judging? Then you have no right to pass a moral judgment. But if supposing you have come to that silence of the mind in which the judgment comes, then you have to have a right to pronounce that judgment. Not the judgment of the mind, but the judgment that comes to the silent mind.
And should we work for social justice? Or should we act in ways to achieve social justice?
No, we must act. But as the Upanishad says, if you can act without the actor, you must act, we must act. Without action we can't live. But at present our action is done by the actor, by that perceiver, that observer, that thinker. If the actor can be silent, and then if the starting point of action comes, then by all means go along that line. But if the starting point is given by the actor, then it is a conditioned judgment. Don't rely upon that conditioned judgment. If you can find in the silence of the mind, it may be for a split second, it does not matter, but if you can come to that silence, then the starting point of action comes and act. Whatever may be the consequences, act in terms of that starting point. Not of the mind, but the starting point that dawns upon the silent mind. Yes?
Could you distinguish between I, or the ego, and being?
I, ego, and the being. I and ego, I make no distinction. But the being is certainly different from the I and the ego. The being is what is. The I and the ego is the image that has been formed. You may call it I, you may call it ego, but that is the image. The being is something which exists by itself. It is not the product of the mind, or it is not the image of the mind.
There seems to be a paradox when one decides to eliminate the I. It's almost like the I maker is now trying to produce a non-I maker, mm-hmm. so to speak. The Amkara is trying to now produce an. How do you get over that, though? I mean, if you're trying, the I is trying to eliminate the I, isn't that the I acting to produce?
The I cannot eliminate the I. It's an impossible thing, because whatever the I does will be to strengthen the I, and therefore the I drops. I cannot be dropped. And the eye drops when the conscious mind is looking at the subject, subconscious mind. Because the subconscious mind is what the eye has gathered. If you look at it, and when the subconscious mind empties itself, then the eye has gone. You have not removed the eye, because the eye cannot be removed by the eye. It has gone. In that very silence, the eye has gone. You do not even realize that the eye has gone.
What I'm saying, though, is that action of trying to do that, it seems like on a very subtle level, when one says, okay, I'm going to be silent.
You can't.
Or whatever, the motivation is still inherently, the intentionality is always there.
Quite right. So long as there is a motivation, the action doesn't take place. Whether it is the removal of the eye or it is coming to silence. Removal of eye, the arriving of silence, these things come, they cannot be brought about.
Would you care to say anything further about indeterminacy as quantum mechanics sees it, and the perfect orderliness of the mindless?
Perfect? Perfect order of the mindless.
To be free.
Yes?
To be free. To let go of the mind. There's a consequence of perfect order.
Yes, yes, I understand.
And yet, earlier you shared with us the cutting edge of quantum mechanics, which had this strong element of disorder, of indeterminacy.
Yes,
is there a connection, or is there not? Would you care to discuss this further?
The quantum mechanics doesn't say that it is only indeterminacy. There is both the determinacy and the indeterminacy. In simple terms, life has two aspects. There is the predictable aspect and there is the unpredictable aspect. Most of us, when we are in suffering, We don't accept the impact of suffering. We go to an astrologer or a palmist. Please tell us what is going to be the future. And the astrologer or the palmist, if he is a true astrologer or palmist, makes a mathematical calculation. And the mathematical calculation can bring you to a high probability. That is what the computer also can do. First-class computer can lead you only up to a particular point, the high probability of a particular thing. It may be 99.9%, but it is still high probability. But there is still a gap between the high probability and uncertainty. That certainty cannot be known by mathematical calculation because of the unpredictable factor of life. And therefore, when we talk of the unpredictable, we don't say that there is nothing that is predictable. There are many things which are predictable. Mathematically, they can be proven. They can be predicted by mathematics. And yet, in spite of all that, there is something which seems to be unpredictable. To be ready for it is to be ready for the order that is established not by me, not the order that is established by my mind, but the order that is established by life itself. There is an order which I make, and there is an order which life makes. In life there is order. The disorder comes in the life of man, because the man wants to impose his order upon the order of nature. If he can say, yes, up to a particular point I can do, but then I must find out what nature wants to do, then I can expedite nature. But I can expedite nature along the lines on which nature wants to go. Then a higher order comes into existence, which is not the order imposed by the human mind, but the order which nature wants to be established. And therefore there is order, there is disorder, both are these things. And man can remove disorder up to a particular point. But there seems to be a point where life seems to be completely playing a game so far as the human effort is concerned. Because nature wants to do something. And if the mind of man does not allow nature to do that, and that is what seems to be happening today, not helping nature and work on with her, but I must become the master of nature, then nature can tolerate up to a particular point. Then there comes a recoil. Who knows, perhaps cancer may be the recoil of nature, we don't know. But there may be a recoil. And therefore you can work with nature, but work with nature in such a manner that you are able to proceed along the lines where nature wants to go, but you are able to show to nature a speedier way than the way that is ordinarily done by nature itself. Yes, yes.
Is being universal, unique, or both?
Both universal and unique. Universal is something which is understood by drawing similarities. That is what we do. When we say that, yes, I have understood the universal, it means I have found the similarities between the otherwise opposing and conflicting viewpoints. But in spite of the fact that I may have discovered similarities, there is something that is unique to each individual, to each unit of life. There is a book written by a scientist who has studied crystals, the nature of crystals. And he says in that book that I have examined no less than 2 million crystals, including the snowflakes. And he says, having examined 2 million crystals, I find that there are no two crystals exactly alike. There is a similarity, but there is a dissimilarity also. There is a symmetry, but there is a dissymmetry also. The dissymmetry is not pronounced. If it is pronounced, then it appears ugly. But dissymmetry is imperceptible, but it is there. Nature has worked on that. It is through dissymmetry that nature puts this stamp of uniqueness on anything that it produces. And therefore, there is universality, but at the same time, there is uniqueness. Yes?
Does it, I would like to continue on the thought that the young man in the front row had about intention and motivation. Is it incorrect or wrong to have a motivation to just watch that part of it? Is there a sequence of that will parlay into something that is not of the mind?
No, I'm not going deep into meditation at all because I have no time. I'm examining only the superficial aspect, that the conscious mind can see, can observe, can witness the activities of the subconscious. without suppressing it. You know, Freud has given an example of how the conscious and the subconscious function. He says, there is a family which lives on the ground floor and there is a family that is living in, on the basement. The basement family is rather wild and mischievous and not quite acceptable to the society. The ground floor family is very respectable, knows what to do at what time. But this basement family has many children. They come up. And they come up in shabby clothes. And they come up just exactly when the ground floor family is engaged in receiving a very important guest. And these children come up. And so the ground floor family says, go down, push down. And the children come up again and again. And therefore at last the ground floor family says, I must appoint a watchman. And the duty of the watchman will be that the children from the basement don't come up. But the children in the basement are very, very clever. They are watching, oh, now the watchman is asleep, let us go up. And it comes up, that is the dreams. What is suppressed comes up in dreams. The watchman is asleep, so let us come up. Or sometimes these basement family children borrow clothes, nice clothes, and come up, and the watchman does not know that these are the same children. Now this is what is happening. If the conscious mind can watch the activities of the subconscious without judgment, just watch, then the subconscious will be able to tell whatever it wants to tell. And in telling, it will naturally become silent. You have not silenced it, but it has become silent.
You say that the Absolute can be known by some method other than the eyes and ears and the mind?
The Absolute is intangible. It is intangibly present in the relative. Intangibly present. The unmanifest is not away from manifestation. It is present in manifestation. If I know how to look at it. But in order to know how to look at it, the seer must be silent. The seer must not intervene. Then I can look at it. Then I will find that in the manifestation itself, there is the inkling of the unmanifest.
What does the Upanishad say about reincarnation and the law of karma? Briefly.
Reincarnation doesn't speak about, Upanishads don't speak about reincarnation or karma in the straightforward manner. But the Upanishads say life never dies. And if life never dies, there is no death at all. Reincarnation, the question of reincarnation comes only when there is death. But if there is no death, where is the question of reincarnation? And therefore the Upanishad is discussing that which is deathless. It is only when you start talking about the images about which we are talking, then the question of reincarnation comes. Since Upanishads speak at that level, they are not concerned with the problems of karma and reincarnation. Yes?
When you talk about Eastern and Western philosophy, give me a description of how you would describe philosophy in the Western world and in your type of a world.
In East, in India particularly, the word for philosophy is something completely different. The word for philosophy, the Sanskrit word for philosophy is darshan. Darshan means perception. It is not speculation, it is perception. And therefore the Indian philosopher, he talked of what he had seen, what he had realized. It was a matter of his realization, not a matter of speculation. In Western philosophy, this is not the aspect of philosophy that has been emphasized. So it is not a perception, it is a speculation. And therefore, while there is the speculative aspect very largely in Western philosophy, I don't say that there have not been mystics. There have been mystics. Mystics both in the East and the West. But by and large, we consider mystics as people who are off their head. And we want to put them aside. But this philosophy which we regard as philosophy, as something which represents the West or the East, this is the difference. One is intellectual speculation, the other is perception. And therefore the Eastern philosophy arises from perception. It's a perceptive philosophy, not a speculative philosophy.
Thank you.